You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
How are you feeling after that, Matt?
I feel a lot better than Bob.
Extra Time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Get lost. Get lost.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Ow, from Brooklyn, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from my apartment and the apartments of all my partners in soccer. I'm Andrew Wiebe, joined by David Goss, Charlie Davies, Matt Doyle. I know what day it is this time, guys. It's Monday, baby. It's Monday. I'm catching up on things. How's everybody doing? Feeling good? Feeling great? Silence? Nobody?
I did a thumbs up because this is a podcast.
Great. Come on, man.
I had some good moments this weekend. I got away from soccer a little bit. Yeah, there was Cameron had his first concert right out here, a front stoop a couple doors down, a guy with an amp, a guitar, and a beautiful singing voice, and just sat out there in some sunshine. I mean, I felt alive.
What kind of music?
It was like folk music. It was good. He enjoyed it.
Like you know, Bob Dylan, 1960s.
Yeah, a little bit of that. A little
Greenwich
bit of that.
Village,
you know?
Folk. Okay.
You got a 2.5-year-old who'll sit on a lap and just hang out for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. That guy was killing it. I got to say. Big show coming up here. Jim Curtin, Patrice Bernier, a couple of legends to talk about Philadelphia Union history and the Montreal Impact's shorter, equal, sort of the same MLS history. We're doing Mount Rushmore's for
and
both
Chicago
of those
Fire.
Teams. Yeah, and also going to get some good Chicago Fire stories, maybe see which is the best team of all time and how that team hit the town together. Before we jump into that, before we hit the mailbag, before we talk about anything else, look, news, it comes thick and fast, sometimes not at all, and then changes the next day. We now know for at least Major League Soccer, we'll be waiting until June 8th for games. MLS extended the moratorium on matches until then. They made that decision on Friday, made it public at least. League play, of course, and this seems like ancient history, though I remember the day very, very vividly, has been suspended since March 12th, obviously because of COVID-19 and the ongoing pandemic. So June 8th, that's the new day. We shall see. These things have changed. I hope that one doesn't. I'm desperate for soccer to return, the rhythm of my life to return. But you know what my new rhythm is, Charlie and Dave? Stumping you guys on Instagram Live on Wednesday nights. Extra Time Trivia Night kicked off last week. Stop. I hope you guys tuned in. Anybody else out there? You know, Dave and Charlie, a lot of talk about the phrasing of the questions.
Yeah, we didn't get the one trash Chivas USA name one goal scorer question.
Smashed it. We smashed his questions.
The best is Charlie does get you. Charlie, you did have some peaks and valleys in there where you were like, this is easy.
That's fair.
And then I'd read the question. You'd be like, this is impossible. Who would write this question?
That's fair.
Yeah. But game of emotions.
I think that the problem was that you created a fake environment in which you pitted me and Charlie against each other when we're both team players. We need to play off each other as a duo.
Yes.
So for the future now, we're one unit.
Yeah. One twos.
Boom.
I don't know if you're going to get back on the field after that performance. You know, like head coach sees that, the lack of
we
connection.
Gotta win.
Man, Wiebe has a lot to say before he goes. Wiebe hasn't gone yet.
I'm ready for this.
Wiebe, the questions are so obvious when you've written them, when you've researched and written them.
That's fair.
I can't wait to see him in action Wednesday.
Kaylin and I on Wednesday on Instagram Live, 7 p.m. Eastern, Extra Time Trivia Night. Mix yourself a drink, crack a beer. If you're under 21, like pour a lemonade or, you know, hydrate, drink some water. Come join Kaylin and I as Dave, you're up. You're on the questions.
Yeah.
You attempt to stump us.
I have a few already written out, but I'm going to work with my guys, Charlie and Doyle over here and get like a good situation going. Basically, okay. I'm going to get Doyle to write 96 questions and Charlie can write questions about things no one knows because he was in the locker room. Boom, face.
That's not, it has to be accessible in some way. I would have had to know about it. Anyway, pour yourself a drink, 7 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday night, Extra Time Trivia Night on MLS's Instagram Live. So follow MLS if you don't already. Come and hang out. We had Sasha Kleshin, Fafa Pico, Mo Adu, Aguchi Onyewu, a bunch of guys in the comments talking trash and bantering with us. So it was a really fun time. Also, some other stuff going on. I hope you watched it. If you didn't, Sunday night was the first eMLS tournament special. It's 5 weeks long. It's basically pairing a player and the professional EMLS pro from each of these teams in sort of the pros play, then the pros play, if that makes sense. And then whoever wins moves on to the final episode. Chicharito couldn't finish in the 18. I just saying, had trouble in the 18. Dio beat him, LAFC beat him, and then
Francisco Calvo got knocked out by Francisco Calvo. Both those guys could score. For defenders, yeah, Rica, those two were fairly focused on goal scoring.
Goal for Francisco Calvo.
Celebrations were nice.
Yeah.
So next Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern, I believe, FS1. Go check that out. Train with MLS is also up, and we're having a great week with MLS Unites. All the information at MLSsoccer.com. You guys want to get into it? You want to do our Mount Rushmore? Start with Jim Curtin?
Let's go.
All right, let's talk some Philadelphia Union, and we'll do so with the head coach, Jim Curtin. What's up, Jim? How's it going? Welcome to Extra Time.
Doing good, guys. Thanks for having me on.
What are you up to this morning, man? Like, I'm always, it's Monday morning for everybody in the world, and we've all got different habits and routines and responsibilities. What are you up to?
Also, why are you broadcasting from a closet?
Like, yeah, it does look small. So I have three kids, and I'm up in the far corner of my house right now. And yeah, it's the only place to get some quiet during all the homeschooling that's going on below me, which I've learned is just thank you to all the teachers out there. They do a heck of a job with our kids. That's for sure.
You don't have to do any of it. You know, no,
I mean,
homeschooling.
I'm trying my best, buddy, but it's difficult. You know, you have different ways of learning math. That's for sure. I've learned that the hard way. No longer is 5 times 4 just simply 20. There's 25 steps to get there. So you're teaching them all those little things and doing your best to keep up. But yeah, they're teachers are doing a good job, you know, visually like this, you know, but also the parents, I think, are struggling a bit as time goes by.
What's more difficult, the salary cap or the math homework you're doing with your kids right now?
Salary cap might change more, actually. So I'd say that is harder. The rules change a lot in our league. So
how are you connecting with your guys right now? I talked to Ben Olsen the other day and he's saying, you know, we're zooming, we're like calling specific guys. We're telling them to go hit a wall and just play wall ball and do their exercise. Like, how do you coach right now?
Yeah, I think initially when we got the bad news and literally were removed from our training field before our home opener, we didn't know how serious this thing was going to be. And then from there, it was just about, you know, connecting with all the guys on the human level, you know, seeing their faces. We have guys from 12 different countries, age 16 through 35. So you just want to make sure that they feel safe. You check in with them. And then since then, we've obviously progressed just like every other team into pretty hard, you know, physical routines that they get on a daily basis. We have film rooms that we break up into defenders, midfielders, and forwards. We're attacking a lot of, you know, different scouting reports on guys just trying to stay active. And then we're also looking at things we struggled with last year, which was, you know, when teams really sat back against us, how do we break them down? So we did a presentation on, you know, breaking down a low block and little ideas like that. So we're staying busy. You're also connecting with other coaches. You know, maybe you're talking with your academy coaches, giving little tips there. I was on a Zoom with the Villanova team, the old alma mater. So there's a lot of things that keep you going and keep you busy. But yeah, I think we're all in this kind of together and finding ways to occupy our time and trying to maximize that as we hope to get going again soon here.
Does Elsinio go with the midfielders or the forwards?
Yeah, I actually, that's a great question. So I kind of, for him, I there's like a, and also Elsinio, but he goes with the attacking.
And you also mentioned the hardcore physical aspect. How much of that is Elsinio doing?
Yeah, you know what? I'll just say this, you know, the Peloton bikes have been, a lot of guys have the means to just go buy them. And then there's probably another tier of guys. If you just Google the Woodway treadmills, I think Charlie knows what I'm talking about. They're about 20 grand and some of the guys have purchased them. So everybody's, yeah. I'll just say everybody's means are a little bit different and everybody's routines, some are body weight based and some have the ability to just say purchase the nicer thing.
is the low block breakdown just give Elsinio the ball in the final third? Or
it's funny because that's a great point, Charlie, because we actually – I go through the clips of teams when they did sit back against us, and I obviously pieced together some of the success we had doing it. And everyone always starts with roll the ball out to Elsinio. He beats two guys, and then everything changes. So, yeah, it was – yeah, I kind of caught myself as I'm talking to the players, you know, like, yeah, it has nothing to do with coaching or any tactics we can do. Certain guys can just break a team down, and he's special that way.
I was going to ask, I know training creates perfection in the game moments. Would you say that coaching Charlie Davies helped you train for dealing with three kids on a daily basis?
Look, Charlie, first of all, Charlie, you talk about you guys. I know I think we'll get into the Mount Rushmore type things. I was fortunate enough to have in my coaching time with the Union, you know, almost a USA at Mount Rushmore with Charlie, with Mo Adu, with you know, with Gooch, with Connor Casey, you know, a lot of guys have come through the Philadelphia Union, and I was fortunate to have time with Charlie. He wanted more playing time and probably in certain moments was deserving of more playing time. But he always let me know when he scored goals in training and how many and in celebrations. It was always like, hey, coach, you know, I scored 4 or 5 again today. And I'm like, I know, but you're still coming off the bench this week.
This is true.
You know,
but the locker room was great.
The locker room was amazing. That was a great group of guys. And I mean, the amount of, you know, memories that I still have from that. And it was a fun group to work with. You know, again, Charlie wanted to play more than he did because he was competitive. You know, but, you know, I sometimes decisions went against him. But at the same time, he still was a big part of the success that the Union had in those years.
We'll get into the Rushmore stuff. I'm curious, as I went back and looked at your career and kind of reminisced on some of it, what the best locker room you were a part of was. What was the best group from the Fire days, maybe the Chivas USA days? I don't know.
From a playing group or
playing group? Yeah.
So it's easily that I stumbled into a lucky locker room in 2001 where I was the young guy, and it was Chris Armas, Jesse Marsh, Ante Razov, Zach Thornton, Josh Wolf, Carlos Bocanegra. You know, I just named a few off the top of my head there. I'm missing a ton. I think there's like 15 guys that are either coaches, GMs, or, you know, involved in the game at a pretty high level. So that environment was a great one to be in, and it was the most competitive training sessions you've ever seen. And again, I'm older than Charlie, but the best teams he was on, the best teams I was on, we got after it so hard in training during the week, to the point of sometimes fisticuffs and different things that got kept quiet, and there was no tweeting about it afterwards or anything like that. But those weeks of training and the film study and everything was so difficult that it made the games almost easy. You know, you'd go out on the field with these guys and they were so special. And again, like, I was lucky. You know, we had Peter Novak, Risto Stoichkov. We just had great players. And I was this 21-year-old kid who literally walked out of a finance class at Villanova and went and tried out for the Fire. It was just different times. There was only 16 players on a roster field-wise, you know, 2 goalkeepers and 16 players, 10 teams in the league. So only 160 jobs. I'll put my hand up and say I was the worst player on the team. And I was still damn proud to be there. And I, you know, learned from that group and kind of evolved. Chivas, we had a lot of, to be honest, reunions, because, you know, you looked in that locker room and it was, again, it was Jesse, it was Ante. So you were always thinking about the game as a coach with that group of guys around you. And the environment creates, I think, future success for players and coaches. So that was a special time for me.
Oh, Doyle, I thought you were going to go.
No, I thought you were going to go. You're pointing at your eye the whole time.
You're pointing left and right. I was like, okay.
So, Jim, I think most of us stayed up last night and watched The Last Dance with the Chicago Bulls. Their great season, some stories that haven't been told. What would be your Chicago Fire version of that? What would you do a 10-part series about, maybe a story people don't know, or the best success?
Yeah, so that was actually, you talk about what we do with our teams right now. So I made it mandatory. I sent out on our Slack app that it was mandatory viewing last night, that our players, I don't care how young or old you are, that you watch this series. Because again, I think we can all learn from other sports. And it was, you know, I'm obviously a huge Jordan guy, and that's the era and generation I grew up with. And when I hear the Bulls opening theme song, I get like chills still to this day. So I want them to feel that. I think there's a lot of things that players can relate to from that series, which is like, you know, the management side of things, what coaches are dealing with on a daily basis, the noise behind the scenes, all those things come up. And then you still have this leader in Michael Jordan, who's the greatest ever, but he also needs his wingman, Scottie Pippen. So, you know, there's so much in there that, everybody can take. I am nervous though, because I'm showing my kid. Now I'm just talking about the Jordan series. You gotta
go for it. We all watched it.
No, the cool thing is now, you know, I'm almost nervous for my little guy to watch it, because you can tell it's coming. Like they're gonna paint the side of Jordan that never really got out. You know, he's gonna be so competitive that I think he's gonna come off a little negative as this thing goes on, which is the first time, because everybody was kind of in it together. There was Nike involved. Everybody had a pact in the media to kind of, we're all making money off of this thing, let's let it go. So he was always protected. So I think some stories will come out. But that was a long-winded answer to back to Chicago. You know, gosh, there's so many stories from that group. You know, we I don't want to name names, man. You get me in trouble. There's too many guys that are in high positions now. There's too many guys that are in high positions all over the league. I'll just say this was in the early days of the Chicago Cubs weren't that popular yet. And I could literally – I lived right around the corner from the Cubs stadium. And I could go in for 10 bucks and just sit in the bleachers by myself. So I would literally like – you could do that. And I'll just say it was a party there. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you may or may not have seen the entire Chicago Fire team stumbling around Wrigleyville. And if there were cell phones and cameras, man, none of us would probably be employed these days. So we worked hard. We worked hard on the field, but we had fun off the field as well. And like all great teams, I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know. They all kind of shared that bond. And the memories from the Wrigleyville, Lincoln Park neighborhood, even when teams came into our town, the games were always tough for them. But then we did go out at night, I would just say, maybe a little harder is a bad word, but a little more aggressive than maybe the players do.
Just like training, man. It was just like training. You gave yourselves ready.
Exactly.
So yeah. I want a story from you, which is your first start, because – correct me, you would have not made this start had not Diego Gutierrez and somebody else got red cards.
We had a double red card and an injury. So again, you talked about like Andrew Lewis had an injury. Diego got a red card. We finished against – so we played away – I won't bore you with the whole thing, but we played away against Columbus, crazy game. Red cards at the end of it, got out of hand. Two red cards, and then an injury happens during the week. And Bob Bradley tells me I'm starting in our home opener at Soldier Field, which was, again, back in the day, man, that environment with all the Polish fans and the supporters of Novak and just how crazy it was there. So I can literally remember Bob telling me that I was going to start in the home opener, literally the opening whistle blowing and the smoke from the fans is kind of clearing. And I'm looking at Marco Echeverry tap the ball off to Jaime Moreno and I'm going, how the hell did I get here? You know? So, you know, like everybody's story, a little bit of luck, timing, right place. And you know, we wound up winning like a bunch of games in a row and I had some success. So again, product of really good players around me.
Well, you touched on it there, seeing Jaime Moreno, Marco Echeverry. Over the course of your career, who was the toughest mark? And did you have one of those moments where, man, yeah, I'm starstruck? Was there another moment where you're like, oh, I cannot believe I'm playing against this guy?
Yeah, that's a great one. So in the league, Jaime was unbelievable, man. He was so fast with the ball. Jaime in his prime, I don't think people appreciate enough. Incredible, almost unguardable. But personally, I actually struggled the most with a guy who still scored a ton of goals but also gets forgotten, Jeff Cunningham. He killed me every time I played him because he would kind of wink at me. He loves playing against me.
Oh, boy.
He was the kind of guy, he would rather embarrass you than maybe score. You know what I mean? So he was doing things to me, and he just had my number, and I could not, no matter what I did, I would try to, you know, one game I'd try and take him out early and kick him at midfield. But nothing I could do. I could never get close. And if you Google Jeff Cunningham's goals, I am involved in way too many. There's a guy with a blonde afro chasing after him. And he was my kind of nightmare. The guy, I was lucky enough to play in some friendlies too when we played against AC Milan. Traded jerseys with Maldini. That was a surreal moment after the game because as a defender, I looked up to that so much. But that level, that was like the Milan team where Kaká had just been sold there. Roy Costa played midfield. Roy Costa megged me twice in the game. not where he like rolled a ball through my legs. He megged me twice on two. They were like 25-yard through balls, and he did it on purpose. He did it the first time. He played to Christian Vieri, a big, huge striker. Yeah, yep. He played it through my legs from – it was like 20 yards away, and I kind of looked at him, and I'm like, I think he might have meant that. Then he got the ball again, dude, and he did it again. And I looked at him again, and he winked at me and just kind of like smiled. I was kind of like – he literally had me – he was playing 20-yard passes through my leg. It was him and some like Gilardino had just gotten there too, a striker from Italy. But again, dude, it was that was a different level, you know, and you're covering Jaap Stam on a corner kick and you're – again, it's one of those surreal moments where – you know, the league was growing and it was kind of like we were almost starstruck on the field as players.
Before we hit Philly and the Mount Rushmore, and we're kind of beating the bush around it, but these stories are too good. I've always been curious about you, Jim. What coaching tree would you say you come from, or would you say you do come from one? You've had a lot of different influences.
I've had a ton of different influences, but I'm a Bob. I'm from the Bob tree. You know, he was the first coach I had. You know, I only was there for two seasons, but the influence that he had on me, you know, and the way I always say it is you just didn't want to disappoint Bob. You know, it was almost more like a father figure than it was a coach, where, again, I've said it many times, if I had a bad game, he would point out all the points in video that I did well. And if I walked into the locker room thinking I played well, he showed me everything I did wrong. So he always kept you on edge. And again, I think the environment he created was most important. And listen, the one thing I learned over time as a coach now, we can all talk about tactics and we can talk about, you know, a million different things that go on in the game. But as a coach, I think it comes down to the relationship that you have with your players. If you can get the most out of them, that's more than anything. Everybody can go on YouTube now and get all Mourinho's training sessions. You can get every Barcelona training session. Any guy can walk into a party and quote some Malcolm Gladwell, you know, BS on leadership. But like the real stuff now is the people that can relate to other players and do they trust you and do they believe in you? I think that's what coaching, the more I look at it now, even when you watch I'll reference the documentary last night, Phil Jackson, you know, he's one of those guys. Popovich, same thing. Yes, they're great with the X's and O's and that stuff is still important, but you know, you hear Klopp talk and he still talks about it's relationships. That's what it comes down to. Nagelsmann, anybody, anywhere you look now, I think it comes down to the relationships that you can have with your players and that trust. And if they'll fight for you, you know, you'll have success. And, you know, when things do go bad, most of the time it's when, you know, 3 and 4 guys go off and start talking in corners and then you can see they don't respect the coach anymore. And that goes. And as coaches, that's what we're trying to avoid at all costs, you know.
What do you do when that happens?
It's going to happen because there's always noise from the outside. I think the biggest message you always try to give in the tough times, and look, I had tough times as a young coach in the league, and I was learning on the fly a lot of those moments. So I think the best thing you can do is have the mindset, and it's not a new idea, but when the door is shut for a film session and it's you guys in the locker room, you have to express to the group that no matter what's said on the outside, this is the only group that matters. This is the only group that will get us through a tough time of losing games. This is the only group who knows what it feels like to walk in the locker room after a win on the road, what that really feels like to people. So again, if you're part of it, you kind of get the feeling, you know, you have certain things in your brain that it almost triggers feelings and you know, you can express that to them as you go through a season. Little things down to, you know, very few guys know what it sounds like when you're walking out of the tunnel and the studs start to hit the concrete. Little weird, I can't curse on this, can I? Little weird stuff that just kind of triggers things. And you share those moments with them. And again, you try to build a trust and relationship with all of them. They all have to have your cell phone number these days. They all have to be able to feel like they can text you. You have to relate to them and understand that, yeah, the times have changed. I'm old now. I'm the old guy. I can't be cool with them anymore because I'm not cool. I'm an old dad. But I still have to relate to them in ways that that connect me with them. So I think that becomes the most important, especially during the difficult times. Because
normally you come in with the fresh cuts. That's all.
Yeah. Oh, it's funny.
Let's do Mount Rushmore, man. I think there are two for the Union that are unquestioned. You put them up and then you work on the rest of the list. I'm curious if you were going to build this Mount Rushmore, players only, by the way, congratulations, Jim, you are the coach for this Mount Rushmore for the Union. I think I can say that without any debate here.
Yeah.
Well, who are the guys you would start with on the Philadelphia Union player Mount Rushmore?
Oh man. So again, this is, and I've seen you guys do these. This is longevity. This is like
when everything. You think of it's you can name
whatever
it,
you want to do.
Just it. Talent.
It's right. Not just talent. Although talent can be a big part of it.
But of course, it's a big part. But if guys. It's just talent, I mean, we're talking about if it's just talent and career, the easy ones are the Ilsenio, Charlie. You've seen that. There's no one better than him. Probably in our league's history, talent wise. If you're just talking, drop him in a 5v2 at Real Madrid, and they'd all be like, "Whoa, this guy's nasty," you know. So. Yeah, Barnetta, gosh, Harris was unbelievable talent, you know, Nogueira, but I would say that they didn't have maybe the longevity that the Rushmore would need. We had cult heroes here. You know, the fans loved Danny Califf. The fans loved Mondragon. They loved Ruiz, but they weren't here long enough. You know, it wasn't long enough to be on that group. I did my all USA team with Mr. Gooch, you know, Moadu, Charlie, and Connor. So that's out of the way. So now you're on to, I think, the obvious. Latu, it has to be, obviously, yep. Just for, you know, the goals, the success, the face of the franchise. You know, he's just a special player, scored a ton of goals, you know, and relates to the fans so well. So that's the easy one. Bedoya, I think, is in that moment now where he is our leader, both on and off the field. I mean, to have the guts to do big things like he did after he scores against DC and his message to the government on gun violence. So again, he's kind of the epitome of a captain and a leader. I don't have to convince Charlie they're good friends. It's hard to be on each other. I mean,
no, I think it was Esch when he got the contract extension. That's now we can say he's officially Mount Rushmore.
Okay, yeah. So he's on there for sure. And by the way, you guys should have heard Charlie and Alejandro. It borders on like some of the meanest stuff you could possibly say to each other. They kind of just laughed it off, and you could tell just how close they were. It's almost like a brotherhood, and it was cool to watch. But man, you guys were mean to each other. I fell hard on my buddies, and we break each other's balls. But man, you were brutal. You guys were brutal to each other in a good way. So now you get into, you know, the final two. I would say, you know, for me, again, another captain, always forgotten in the history of our league for some reason, was a champion, was a winner, you know, had the burden of, you know, speaking to the press when things maybe weren't so good in Philadelphia. You know, Brian Carroll, for me, again, kind of one that, you know, maybe people don't remember, but he almost played 200 games for the club, probably with Open Cup. He might be up around that, I think 160-something in the league. Great guy to work with, and you talk about in different moments, needing that voice in the locker room. I think of Bedoya and I think of Brian Carroll as guys that were big helps for me. So maybe I'm being selfish. Also involved in the financial world and manages what little money that I have. So Brian's a winner. He's just a great person. I get excited just talking about him. Every coach that's had him loves him. And a guy who maybe never got the accolades that he should have in his career as a real winner. So I'll put him on there. You know, now the face of the team, Ray Gattis might not – he should be – it's between him and Andre right now. Yeah. So that's probably my two. And now I'm going to get in trouble because I coach both of them. So they're mad at me. So you guys aren't going to let me, like, cut their face in half and do half.
No, you got to pick one. Gotta be one.
I had Ray. And Andre.
I had Andre.
I went to UConn. I went to UConn, so I have Andre.
But yeah. I had Ray. Just because I feel like Ray's longevity, the odds that he just keeps piling up. I mean, by the time he retires, he'll probably be the all time leader in appearances.
That's not Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, no, look, Ray,
Mount Rushmore. Not cult hero, not like fan, not being like there every day doing his job, which he does. And I have so much respect for Ray because he's a grinder.
Yeah.
No matter how many players come in that are quote-unquote better than him or have more talent than him or expected to play, he shows up, he does his business, and then he goes home. And he comes back the next day and repeat. That's Ray Gattis. You're always going to know what you're going to get from him. He's consistent. But we're talking about Mount Rushmore. You got to also throw in talent. You also got to throw in, you know, influence on the field, the locker room, everything. And I think Andre Blake, I mean, this is a goalkeeper of the year. You're talking international level.
Yeah.
Keep putting Jamaica on the map at times because with his performances. That's why, for me, I have to give it to Andre Blake. But all due respect to Ray Gattis and what he's done for the club and the amount of minutes he's garnered in his
career. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right on that. You know, Andre has the All-Star games. He has the, you know, the goalkeeper of the year. He has the individual accolades. But there's no better team player and no better kid that you would want your son to be than Ray Gattis. Like, he is literally the epitome of a professional, the epitome of amazing in the community, off the field. He's such a winner. And then on the field, man, lockdown defender. Like, he's one of the few guys I watched when he would mark Thierry, and Thierry like jokingly will say it too, like this kid was relentless, and he, you know, just one on one, you talk about just shut down an entire side of the field. Ray was special that way. So yeah, I'm stuck on this as well, but I'll go with you know, I think I'll go with Andre. You know, it's a tough one for me, but maybe Ray could knock off BC.
Can I go back? But then you got
to play. The other one's got your money. So it's like, you're rocking
hard. Plus, you got the young guys coming in. Brendan Aaronson, you know, Fontana, McKenzie, all these guys that will potentially be on Mount Rushmore.
Well, actually, I want to ask this question, Jim. If 10 years from now we're having this conversation and Brendan Aaronson's on the Union Mount Rushmore and Mark McKenzie and maybe Fontana and Real, has something gone wrong for the Union? Because isn't the ideal that like sometime in the next year or two, you guys will sell these great young players?
I think we have to. I think that's our next step as a club. Otherwise, you're not good enough, you know, or you haven't made them good enough. You know, I haven't done my job having them reach their full potential because I see it every day. And look, it's like the Goodwill Hunting line when he says to him like, you know, if you're here tomorrow, like I'm going to kick your ass kind of thing, you know, like you should be gone. You have to go on. It's the best thing for you. I love you, but you have to go on to the highest level. So, Brendan would be in that category. McKenzie as well. Whereas if they are on our Mount Rushmore, something didn't go right. You know, I think they have the ability to be our first. And look, our club's done better each year and we've gotten a higher point total each year. It's been a more gradual build just philosophically on how the club works, but the next step is who's going to be that first guy, and that's on me as a coach to try to get the most out of them. It's always a little bit on the player. I think the one piece of development nobody wants to talk about anymore, at a certain point development is on the player too, you know what I mean? Like we keep saying all these young kids and the coach didn't do it or the GM didn't do it. At a certain point, Charlie will tell you, it's you. You have to look in the mirror. You have to have the guts to go overseas. You have to really, really want to. And guess what? It's mean over there, man. They don't look after you. They don't try to help you. They don't put their arm around you, where we kind of do in America. We're a little naive that way. In a good way, we're friendly when internationals come into our locker room, where it's not the case like that over there. So I want that for our club. I think that is the next way we can inject money into, whether it be a DP, whether it be into, you know, back into our youth academy. So there's urgency to have that first one.
I think as we do the best team bracket, Jim, I think last year's team's got to be the team. I don't really think there's a ton of debate there. Agree? Yeah. Disagree? I mean, clear playoff game.
Yeah. It was a good team. Really, really talented.
2016 was good.
You guys had a lot of talent. We were good on paper, but we didn't do it.
You want to play off game, Charlie?
Yeah. Hey, we lost at Toronto. Come on, man.
That was a good team. That was a good team. That was a really good team. And we were actually in that game late, but now I'm going to get upset. But yeah, that team was a good group. I think, yeah, that had Barnetta going. Barnetta was hurt in that game. That was a good team. That was a really dangerous team to play against. But, yeah, this group last year I think was probably our best in terms of winning games on the road. In 2016, we didn't win a lot on the road, which I always think is the best test of a great team. Can you go into somebody else's building and win? And last year we had a pretty darn good road record, and that was a special group for sure.
We were looking forward to this year. Last one, then we'll get you out of here and back to work. June 8th is the new date, and they keep shifting and changing. As you think about this season from a coaching perspective, I've seen some people saying, hey, this has to have an asterisk on it. And we're hearing, you know, Commissioner Don Garber saying maybe the format could change. It depends on how this goes. As you look at that from a coaching perspective, and also just someone who's so invested in the league, what are the thoughts that pop through your mind when you think June 8th, a different sort of schedule potentially, and just 2020 MLS in general?
Look, before I say anything, I think you have to stress that the health of everybody is most important, right? Sports are great, the great unifier, and we all miss them a ton. And gosh, I would love to be able to turn on the NBA playoffs right now and just dive into that. So it's hard for us in that regard. So safety still, though, comes first. Whenever we do play, whatever it is, you know, like it's been mentioned, you know, an abbreviated tournament, a shortened schedule. I don't know what the answer is to that, but whatever it is, the one thing we control right now, and I've been stressing this to all the athletes, is how in shape you are when we do start this thing, because we are going to start it at some point, is going to be the real one competitive advantage that's out there. So take the fitness side of things very serious right now. Everyone's going to have rust when we do start up again on the ball for sure, and that's going to take some time. But can we now be the team that's in really good shape? Will there be an asterisk next to it? I think there has to be at some point. This isn't normal times for anybody. So I think when you talk about our game, when you talk about baseball, when you talk about the NBA, it's a unique situation. It's something that's going to alter the history books for sure. And all we all want to do now is get back out there, do what we love, have that return to normalcy so you guys can be breaking down all the games right now, talking about who's playing well, who's not, which coaches are on the hot seat, and all those fun topics. So I think that's just what we all want. We want that return to normalcy. And look, our leadership in this league has been exceptional, to be honest, from Garber down to the owners in the league. I've never felt more comfortable, you know, with my ownership group and them talking and just being great leaders. And Jay Sugarman, Richard Leibovich, Richie Graham, letting us know where things stand, and whatever the solutions are that come to us as coaches and players have to be ready for it. Look, it's a long, winding road we're all on right now, and we don't really know what the end is going to be. But we all got to make the best out of every day that we have. And this was fun talking with you guys, and I could go on forever about the old stories and the good old.
Oh, so can we. So can we, Jim. Until we hear those cleats clicking on the concrete again. Oh. Sometime soon. Thanks for joining us, man.
People know what I'm talking about, I think.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. Have a great one, man.
All right, guys. We'll
take care, Jim.
Thanks a lot, guys. Good to see you.
All right, do we agree? Jim Curtin helping us out here. He did his prep. He knew. He might have been lying to us saying he's seen the other ones, but he knew. He knew he was going with. I still hurt for Raymond Gattis, but I understand the logic. I think Jim's logic and Charlie's logic is steady there. Brian Carroll, I'm glad he got a shout out. Anybody we would push into that conversation that should be there, or is this group pretty small?
I think it was that group, right? Yeah. The decision was between Andre Blake and Raymond Gattis. What I want to do is, after training resumes and these guys can see each other again, I want to get Jim and Ray on the show to talk about how Ray behaves himself on the first practice back. Because if I'm Ray, I'm thinking about going studs up on somebody. I'm thinking about demanding the ball.
See, that's not Ray, though. See,
maybe it is now. Maybe we're
consistent on the Ray. Lever. He's not going to change anything. He's going to be the same way as always, which is 100%. And you can't get rid of him. You can't like think he's going to disappear, because he's always there. He's always invested mm-hmm. in training. He's always invested in being there as a professional. So, again,
Curtin was basically coaching through our show.
Yeah,
like he knew who he could let off and who he had to reward.
Jim had his list right next to him. You could tell he already had those four names right there.
And I just want to make one more point. We've now had UConn guys on Mount Rushmore for three consecutive teams. Last week on Monday, we had Bobby Ryan on FC Dallas. Then we had Kyle Larin on Orlando City. Now we got the great Andre Blake on Philadelphia Union. So I'm happy, guys. I'm going to just take it easy for the rest of the
show. It's a very UConn move, taking the, we all couldn't think of anyone else, so we put Kyle Larin on, and then celebrating it like a championship. Just go to Boston, dude. No one cares. I will add this one.
Kyle
Mondragon should get more respect. That guy is a god. When you talk about the things Temo did and the rock star that he was, and we've talked about it with Beckham, and we'll talk about it with Drogba later. Mondragon was up there of like, when he came in the league, everyone who was a fan of Colombia was like, oh, really? That guy plays now? And when he played in the 2014 World Cup for Colombia, that was one of the greatest moments in World Cup history. Done.
Look, he's reaching. This is called reaching.
Yeah, let's
Mondragon.
Let's talk Carlos Valdez, Dave. So for the Union, coach Jim Curtin, that was an easy one. Nobody else has won a playoff game in their history. Sebastian Lecheu, that's the first one that goes on there. We got BC, Brian Carroll, Andre Blake, and Alejandro Bedoya, the captain of that team, that won that playoff game. Plus Alejandro is going to put more into it down the line. And then the best team, got to be 2019. I think that's pretty easy. Apologies to you, Charlie. What is the final thing here for the Union before we move on to Patrice Bernier, the impact? How are we honoring El Seno? What is El Seno's part in this monument?
Oh. So what I would say is this. You know, when you go to some of these older hikes or monuments or things, sometimes the the stairs are a little worn down of the marble and they're a little slippery. I think that's the El Seno experience of we just basically cut down all the stairs and you just fall. But when you get up, it's such a great experience. And that's that El Seno roller coaster.
It's like defending El Seno. You're probably going to end up on your butt. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay. Cool. All right. Montreal Impact time. Some big names on the list. Maybe DeVayo, maybe Nesta, maybe Drogba. But the biggest of them all, I got to say, it's Patrice Bernier. Dave, you and Charlie sat down. Let's take a listen.
All right, guys, let's get down to brass tacks. We got deadweight out. Matt Doyle and Andrew Wiebe are going out to, I don't know, hang out. We heard police in the background, so Doyle might be in trouble. But we got the legend in the house, the Montreal Impact God himself, Patrice Bernier. Patrice, bonjour. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks. Bonjour, guys. So thanks for having me on the show. And good to see you guys look healthy and still buzzing about soccer. So it's good.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on so that you can explain to us what's going on in Canada, because me and Charlie over here in the U.S. are stuck, not anything to do. How's it been going in Montreal?
It's drastically things have just shut down. As you know, first days that MLS started postponing training and games, but in Montreal and in Canada, slowly the dates also kept going further and further. Everything was shut down till May, then June. Now it's looking like July, and most major events in Montreal have been postponed to 2021 because everything that's public has been closed till almost August. Most likely, maybe things will change if the curb goes down, but it just seems the more and more we go further ahead, even schooling, they were talking about maybe letting the kids go back to school, but that's all, that's on hearsay. So right now, yeah, everybody's right now I'm at home taking care of the kids. Most time I've been at home for a while, even the beginning of the season. Enjoying the time with the family, really, and connecting with the coaches. Actually, today we connected with the club, with the players a bit. But yeah, we're just waiting for normality and for everybody's health to come back to what was once before, I don't think it'll ever come back to what it was, but we're trying to do what we can, what we have. And like I said, I'm blessed. I have three kids. We're healthy. We're home. Still get to eat. And I've discovered that I'm the new phys ed teacher for my kids.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm lucky. My wife is a teacher, so they do the schooling with her. And then afternoon, we go outside and play, and I test out other I even test out certain soccer things with my daughters, and my son's 2.5, so we'll see. We're putting things in his head. Once he starts playing, he's ahead of the game.
You guys have one advantage over us, though. At least all this bad news, at least, is in French, so it sounds better than what we're dealing with here in the U.S. It sounds romantic. It sounds beautiful when they make the news announcements.
To be honest, I cut because every day it's news. It's just about death toll, curve, more people, and I feel like it's just negativity. And I know we can't change it, so at the end of the day, I try to listen to news a bit, but I don't think this type of news, either it's in French or in English, is it might sound to the ear better, but
yeah,
it's still bad news, it seems, though. So I'm trying to keep my kids surrounded with the everyday things that keeps them focused, keeps them concentrating, and also, you know, trying to be creative. The way I look at it is we're all trying to find new ways to create content, to make our kids or ourselves motivated and go throughout the hours and the days.
Charlie, you lived in Sochaux. Do you want to transfer this interview to French? Do you want to do that with Patrice?
No, my French.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
My French is rusty. My French is too rusty for that. That would
rusty like he ever had it.
I did for a little bit. How have you developed as a coach during this process? What are some of the things you're doing in particular to help you become a better version of yourself?
As a coach, really, I started looking maybe more ideas because, you know, you're the assistant coach. So at the end of the day, there's the main coach who has ideas and you're going through. But me, it's my ideas, what I like about soccer, because, you know, you guys now watch games. But when you were playing, you watched the opposition. You didn't dissect everything, choices of coaches. Now it's really a groundwork of not just your methodology or your philosophy. It's also how would you carry yourself as a coach? What type of coaches that I like in the past that I want to replicate or have I the way their demeanor, to use it as how would I would be able to talk to players and be clear. And like I said, with my kids, I work on small small one-on-one things that I'm like, okay, I know literally it might not work, but it's just to see, is there a progression on if I'm trying something with them, do they get better as we try it even more? So it's kind of like going back to basics, more groundwork of soccer and seeing how I, as I've always been more on the one-on-one aspect. So I try to see what can we bring that's different to a kid. And usually most great coaches, if you see, have tested things somewhere and then after that applied it to the professional ranks. So reading all the stories, how things are going, and just trying to stay fine-tuned. But I would say it's not easy because I got three kids, so I'm spending most of the days with them.
Yeah, yeah.
They keep me on my toes. And then at the end of the day, I try to catch up on what's being thought about and watch a bit on the more, like I said, the fine-tuning one-on-one coaching.
Before we get into Montreal Impact history and this Mount Rushmore and all of those things, the current storyline with your club was Thierry Henry coming in, not just big name, but what he was going to do to the club, how it was going to change. And you'd started with the success in CCL so far. But I've talked to you about Henry and how he works, and you've mentioned his intensity, his passion that players feel in training. Is he getting that across, you know, digitally now? How is he working with this group? How is the group staying connected?
Right now, in terms of the team staying connected, they're mostly connected with the physical preparator, because it's to make sure that are they doing the work. They log in, chatting a bit. Like today, we had a group chat, so it's just to reemphasize the guys. You know, you're professional athletes. I know it's difficult, but and knowing Thierry, and you guys had to, we've played against him. You've talked to him. You know how he is. His standards are very high. He's always seen it in terms of, you know, I think it's funny because we just talked about The Last Dance, Michael Jordan, the Bulls. I think Thierry's in that mindset where it's a natural thing. You should be training. So it's just to reemphasize to the group, like, stay committed, because we don't know when things will turn around and we'll be able to train again. And we have to be on the ground and running. But like I said, it's the intensity, his standard. Thierry has always been known for somebody who has high demand of himself, and I think he applies it to others. And you could see from the beginning of first day what he wants, but he's also realistic of how it transponded. And the last games, we could see that things are now certain things that you maybe had to repeat, you had to do less of, and you're talking about other stuff now. So with Thierry, yeah, it's intensity, it's high standards. And he's so quick to see the game and see little details, not just in terms of the opposition. It's just players, the way they take the ball, or flaws, or good things, to read the passing lanes and stuff like that. And it's offensive and defensive. So it was really interesting to see how fast he sees things, and he tries to apply it and put it into the team. And then you see the players starting to interact. And also now, I think the main thing he wants to come across is players to think for themselves, so that it's not the coach having to tell you what to do. It's you realizing the situations and adjusting. So the last few weeks, you could see certain things that were stressed upon the first few days were now ingrained. And now you could carry on to the next step.
Right. What's been the biggest adjustment for you working with a coach like Thierry Henry?
Really, it's funny because with Thierry, things go quite smoothly. We had conversations before. I knew him as a player, and we always chatted a bit. So we exchanged a lot on football. So now it's just, yeah, sometimes you bicker on certain things. But, I mean, Thierry, the people know Thierry as the player, very high demand. Almost feel like, you know, you're always trying to catch up, and fuck, it just seems like you can't please him. But he's a very outgoing guy, funny, and gets the humor going. It's just that when the switch turns on, when it's business, Thierry is like, no, there's no, we don't cut any corners. This is the way we're going to go with it. And that's, so he's driven, and it's very good. And let's not lie, it's Thierry Henry. So the players know that, you know, he's just been voted the greatest player of the Premier League, voted by fans. But of course, so, you know, he's proved it on the field. So when he says something, players go, look, this guy played at the highest level. And if he's like this, then I got to start doing the work to try to not be like him, but have that those characteristics that made him that type of player, that persona, that way of seeing the game and wanting to be more and evolve as a player.
So let's talk about Montreal Impact history. I'm going to make it easy for you. We've got this Mount Rushmore. We're going to go four players. You are on that list. So you don't have to say yourself if you want to be sheepish.
You're already automatic.
You're done. You're up there. 5 years, but USL days as well, CCL finals, MLS playoff experiences. You are on that list, Patrice. Who goes on that list with you?
Now, do I put the USL pass of the club into this Mount Rushmore?
No, or is just we're doing MLS only.
MLS.
Okay, so now we take out Mauro Biello, and because he had most of the record, or he still has most of the records of the club. First, I'm pretty sure it's easy. It's Nacho Piatti. So he's actually beaten some of Mauro Biello's records. Less time in the 5 years as he was at the club. Scoring, and you know, we've talked about him, and you guys have talked about him. He was at one point easily top five in the league. For me, top three when he was at his best. So I think there's no question about it. You know, you put Nacho Piatti's name in the Mount Rushmore. Then after that, it's okay. Let's say, sorry, the cliche, but it's the impact. Is it the big name that had an impact at the club for maybe a short period of time, because now you're talking about Di Vaio, who was there for three seasons, was MLS candidate MVP in 2013. He's there with the records in a short period of time. In 2014, we were poor, so imagine had we been decent, probably would have better records. And then you have Didier Drogba, who came in for a very short period of time, but had a high impact. He had 11 goals in 11 games in a short period of time. And I think he helped also in terms of the culture, the mindset of the players to believe in bigger than just themselves in 2015, 2016. Then after that, there's the other players that I have to add on because they did very well. Laurent Simon was Defender of the Year. Evan Bush has some of the records of the club, and he's been there for quite some time, and he's the player with the most games played. He's a goalie, but still, he has the most games played. He's been at the club for a while, and he started in USL. And then you have Hassoun Kamara also. So Hassoun, in terms of right back, at one point, he probably one of the stellar right backs in the league. He's up there in terms of games played and the game started. But if I have to choose... Yeah, players who marked the club, even though it was for a short period, and also marked the league, if I'm going to say. It's not just the club, but so you have to go with Marco Di Vaio, MLS MVP candidate 2013, All-Star Game 2013, second top goal scorer that year. At one point, if he wasn't scoring, I don't think we were winning. And then, I think I have to put Didier Drogba because for the short, even though he was there for a short period of time, the club, he just goes above. He brought the club to another level. People start talking about, like, of course, we're talking about us because Thierry Henry is there, but people start talking about the Montreal Impact more. Drogba, and he delivered because most people were like, yeah, he's coming in to take his last paycheck. Can he really score? But then he did 11 and 11. And imagine had he played the whole season, maybe we would have been finished a bit higher in the league. We could have competed, probably been a candidate for MLS Cup. And then you'd say in 2 years, we made the playoffs and we went further. 2015, we went to conference final, semifinals, and then we went to the conference final the next year. So I think he had a say... an impact on that period of time. So those are the four names I would say, not wanting to take away because Hassoun Kamara stayed a few years and had impact, but I mean, they were considered stellar at their positions in the league. They were considered top. If you talk Drogba, you clearly top strikers in the league at that time. Marco Dibao, same thing. And we don't have to really talk about Nacho Piatti because he was in the top five. So those are the four.
Patrice.
I would say the Mount Rushmore.
You talked about these guys, and they're among some of the best in the league, not just your club, the league. What was it like as a midfielder playing with Piatti, Dybala, Drogba? What separated them from everyone else that you've played with? And are there any good stories in training in the locker room that you can provide about these guys?
Marco, starting with Marco Dybala, when he came, you know, Charlie, we're North American players. When a European guy who's established himself comes in, you want to say, hey, I can play with you. I wish I had the chances to play in a bigger league, but I can still play with you now. Mm-hmm. So when Marco Dybala came, me, it was like, okay, he's played with Juventus and Monaco, played with players that they see the game like this. So you want to say, hey, I can feed you the same type of passes. So, but I would say personally, in terms of striker, probably the player was the easiest to play with. I combined the best because I knew his movements. You were a striker, Charlie, you know, he was always on the line, playing at the cuff of the offside, peeling off the blind side of the defender. So I knew when I have the ball, this is the movements he's going to do. He's going to check and go on the outside. So how can I just get him the ball in that space? And I knew his first steps, even at 38, were still faster than most players. So I would say the player that, in terms of cohesion and being in sync, Marco Dybala was easy because I had the ball. Sometimes I didn't even look. I just put it there, chipped it over, and I knew he had already made the move and he was thinking of that pass. It was just, and then in training, you just saw him. He always did extra. It was in the gym. He would go on his own, do his routine, set up, and you're like, guys, he's 38. Look at him. He could just be coasting and saying, ah, score goals. No, he's taking care of his body. Even when he has a drop period, he was in front of the goals, trying to get the repetition, get going. And I know people always looked at him as like his hands always went like, oh, I didn't get the pass. Oh, I'm offside. I think it's an Italian thing. It's always looked like his drama. But as a person, he was a top guy, top professional. I love because then at that time also, I think Alessandro Nesta kind of came towards us because they're like very good friends. They grew up in Lazio together. So to sit down with them and to chat, and then we're chatting football, and then you're telling yourself, oh, I'm in the conversation. These guys let me join their circle of trust. So for Dybala, that was that. And like I said, he was the first DP. And I think he set the benchmark saying, look, yeah, I'm not here just to take a check. I'm here to prove that I can play and make this team better and go further.
Did they both speak French?
Yeah, because Marco, the thing, Dybala, most people, Nesta spoke English and Italian, but Marco played in Monaco. And so he spoke French, and I already knew that. So, and next to the locker room, I'm 8, he's 9. So clearly we're sitting next to each other. And so I always chatted with him in French. And I must say, I slowly developed Italian because I had Dybala, Nesta, Ferrari, Felipe speaks Italian. I had Pisano, Paponi, it was 7-8 players speaking Italian. And my wife is half Italian, so kind of developed certain words. But no, it was just great because at that moment, I'm like, man, these guys are Serie A players. I used to watch them on TV, and now they're teammates of mine. They're playing in Montreal. I'm not playing on the other overseas. They're playing here in my club, in my city. So it was just fantastic to be with them. Talking about Drogba. I don't think the people at the club or in Montreal knew how big he was until he arrived. I don't know if you remember when he arrived that day. Oh, yeah. I don't know if you know the scenes. The airport was jam-packed. I don't remember a player in the league having this type of impact at their own local area. I think Kaká in Orlando, people were like, Beckham was a big deal. But, I mean, people literally flocked to the airport to greet him. There was thousands and thousands of people. And I don't think the club knew how he was a great player, big time. But I don't think they knew the global appeal because of what he did when he was Ivory Coast, stopped the war, went to a cup, and that he has that UN ambassador, that charisma. And the jersey sales the jerseys were gone. We didn't even have letters anymore at the club to print for the players because Drogba was consuming all the sales. So they had to tell people, sorry, we don't have any more Drogba names. We have to wait. So it was funny. But the minute he got on the field, I remember first training session, I was watching with Asun camera. He was playing Joker. He was getting the ball and he was just striking it right, left foot, passes, shots at ease. And the thing that was me and Camara actually were that marked us that is like we were saying, you know, Didier was known as a power striker, but technically he was sound. And we were like, man, imagine like Neymar, Hazard, because Drogba, he's like his level of technique is this high. And when you saw him in training, you're like, okay, these guys are just above us. They're just on another level. You can see they played Champions League, Premier League titles, and World Cup. You could see that their level is just, everything just comes faster, quicker, and their efficiency. Most kids, when you talk to them or young players, you're like, try to finish in one touch. And then when you have guys like that come in, you say, look, did he take a touch? Did he dwell on the ball? Did he try to make the guy look bad? No, he just put it in the goal. Do you understand that that's the mindset? That's, you have maybe one shot, one opportunity. And you have to take it. Yeah, I'm quoting 8 Mile soundtrack. but is that, and then I think the greatest thing about Didier is his charisma and his ease as making everybody part of the team. He made my life easier. I wasn't even playing with Copas at the time, but I was still captain. And you're trying to make the guys understand, look, you're playing for the Montreal Impact. We want to do things. And when he came, he didn't go, hey, follow me. He just performed. He said, first and foremost, I have to go on the field. I'm here because I'm Didier Drogba, and I want to prove that I'm here for the right reasons. And then he was inviting guys to the house, paying for team meals, and just chatting with guys. Guys were like, wait, this guy played with Chelsea and he's just chatting with us like he's one of the boys. And I think that's the human factor for me, Didier Drogba, is when people ask me, hey, Drogba, it was fantastic. I said, yeah, the player, great. But I mean, the human being, even higher.
Superb, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And to finish off, Nacho Piatti. I didn't know who Nacho Piatti was when he arrived in 2014. So I don't know if everybody, because he was from South America. We knew he was a great South American, but we didn't really watch clips. It wasn't like he was playing in Europe. So I was like, Nacho Piatti, okay, we spent money on this guy. He seems like he's a great player, but he's playing San Lorenzo. It's not Boca Juniors, not River Plate. But the first training session, first touch on the ball in passing drills, I said, okay, this guy's different. You know, Charlie, when you're on the field, you see certain guys, the way they caress the ball. I had just the map. So he's the type of players where it's so smooth. It yep. looks easy. And you're like, now it's just, will it translate to MLS? Because it's a much more physical, athletic league. Players tend to get knocked off the ball a bit easier without fouls being committed or called. So I was like, this guy has something different. And then he just chopped players in training easily. And I will always remember, I was with him in training. We did 3v3. And at one point, he took the ball. It's the type of stories that, you know, people say, oh, Lionel Messi, he's the only one who does this in training. No, I saw Nacho Piatti. I was with him on the team. He got the ball. I was free, but he didn't give me the ball. He just chopped one, went down, chopped another one, went down, chopped the third one, went down. Goalie came, didn't just finish it, put it in the corner, and then, like, finish. No, chop the goalie, lobbed it over him, put it in. And then you stop and you just go. Then you go, this guy is just things just easier.
That chop. It's something else.
Nah, it was, yeah, it's a chop like you, even if you know it's coming, he still gets you.
So Patrice, we gotta let you go. We gotta get Andrew and Doyle back in here because I don't know, for some sad reason. Real quick, last one. We're doing best team, best group. For each club, I think it's 2016. Do you have any disagreement there?
You think the best overall team was 2016? Nah, for me, best overall, 2015.
Yeah, I'd say 15 as well.
I think, look, when Laurent Simard, the back was stellar. You had Hassoun Kamara, who was still very good. In the midfield, at one point, even though I didn't play, still Coker, Donadel, Bernier, You had Venegas coming off the bench, who was still not really known. And then you had Dili Duka, who was doing well. Justin Mapp was not even really playing because he's coming from injury. And then you had Piatti and Drogba.
Yeah.
But the team who played the best. Yeah. So we had some – that was a good core team. I think 2016 things went well and we finished off strong. So we looked better. But overall, I think 2015 was better. But the team that I enjoyed the most playing with was 2012. End of the season 2012. Because with Felipe and Colin, I just found the chemistry with them easy playing and they were young. I felt we had the right mix experience with young guys hungry that want to prove themselves. And we were with Jesse Marsh, who wanted to instill a playing philosophy. And I'm the type of player who wants to play the Barca way, if you could say. So 2012 is the one that I enjoyed the most. But I think generally 2015 was the most complete team.
Well, Mount Rushmore, there it is. The man who's on it himself, giving us the rest of the list. And he agreed with Charlie, so Charlie's okay with it. And we can disagree later if we need to.
Ale, ale, ale.
Did I miss somebody? Did you put it?
No, not at all. No.
He put Evan Bush in there. He put Evan Bush in there.
I would push
him. That's why I said, because Evan, then it's longevity, what you've done for the club for longer. That's why Mount Rushmore is always like highest impact or you become more consistent and you help the club grow for a longer period of time.
So it's fine.
A little bit of both.
Charlie picks the biggest names in each club and just goes down from there. And you got to make an argument against
it. I believe that because they lived up to the hype.
Fair. Yep.
Usually some don't, and they lived up to the hype. And they made
well
us.
Said. Merci beaucoup.
Bienvenue.
Patrice always lives up to the hype. He's always our favorite guest. Patrice, stay safe. Best to your family. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys. A pleasure. Keep it up.
All right.
Stay safe.
All right. Where'd we settle? Who we got, guys? Patrice, nail it. You guys nail it?
Charlie's the one who had the perfect list, so he can read you through it.
Literally, I think I'm like 15 for 15 in these. That's all I'm going to say. It's Patrice Bernier, 1, and then we had Piatti, 2, Davao, 3, and Drogba, 4. That was the list. That was his exact list, man for man.
So
got to have Drogba.
I brought up greatest team, and I thought it was would be 2016, because when you look at 2016, you brought Laurent Simon and Ayongo in 2015. Drogba came in the end of 2015, obviously, as Patrice said a couple times, 10 goals and 11 appearances once he got in. Then you move into 2016, all those guys get a little more cohesive, and then you added Mancosu and Donadel on loan, who both ended up being starters part-time here and there. But Patrice was pretty adamant that 2015 was the best team, that when Drogba came in, the high they hit was the best that they'd been. And
he was at his best. Drogba was at his best in that 2015 run.
And his backup basically.
I would agree with him.
Okay. And his backup seemed for Patrice to play was 2012, the style that they played with and the way that they played under Jesse Marsh. So I don't know how you guys feel there.
I feel like Patrice was in the locker room. He saw this in person. I kind of feel like we got to trust Patrice and go 2015, but my gut would have said 2016 too.
But this,
like, Drogba in 2015 was unbelievable. Like everything about him, whether it was the off the field stuff and you saw the entire city just like on fire. I remember when he arrived at that airport. Normally you see those airport shots and it's like, yeah, I know what you guys did. You jammed everybody into the shot and you got the framing right and it looks like it's absolutely mobbed, but the rest of the airport's pretty easy to navigate. The Drogba one was like people are like falling out of exits. People are just in random spots. You couldn't walk. I mean, that seemed like an absolute rock star situation. And then he came out in the league and you're like, well, he's making this look like child's play. So I'm going to trust Patrice.
Yeah. I mean, people are hanging off the airport. Like people are hanging on the signs and just to get a glimpse of him.
No, I agree with that. 2015 is the year that's the only year that they went over 50 points. It's the only year that they finished in the top 10 overall in league standings. They actually made it further in the 2016 playoffs, but I mean, to me, playoffs is always just such a coin flip. And in 2015, that series against Columbus won, I think, 4-3 on aggregate. Really underrated, really intense series. And that was the Drogba leg lock series. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I think it was Steve Clark. He grabbed Steve Clark and he hugged him. And it became like that was an epic and kind of forgotten great MLS playoff series.
The only thing that stands out in my mind, and I agree with all of what you've said, is how long it took Laurent Simon to get comfortable in MLS, and that 2016 he was such a better player. Because you remember in 2015, dude got like three red cards in the first 3 months of the season because he was yeah, out.
But,
that,
but towards the end, he was great.
Fair. That's fair. He figured it out in 2015 mm-hmm. to go along with that final run. So I'm fine with that.
All right, I think we played them in Montreal at Stade Saputo towards the end of the season. And the partnership between him and Cabrera was probably at its peak when they were playing in 2015. And then Drogba was on fire. So that's why I would have said that 2015 year.
Charlie, did you get a Didier Drogba jersey game worn?
Oh, you had to bring that up.
I'm just wondering, you know, you have such a sparkling collection. And
it's literally the one jersey that I really, you know, being a striker, respecting somebody. And then London Woodbury started that match and went to Drogba directly and got the jersey. And I was like, anybody else but him. You had to take DDA's. I thought it was claimed, but so that's.
Do you talk about it before a game?
Yeah, how does that work? Did you try to claim it?
Yeah, I mean,
conversation.
Yeah, some people talk about like, oh, like, you know, someone that was your role model. You get a first chance to play against him. You know, for when I played against Thierry Henry for the first time, and him being like my idol, I think I was like, no one even think about switching jerseys with him. But in this game against Montreal, you know, we were the defending MLS Cup, you know, finalists. We wanted to like get back into the playoffs. It's a big match against Montreal. You weren't really talking about jerseys, although I think everyone inside internally was thinking, man, Drogba. And you have guys on certain teams who really are all about trading jerseys. I was one of those guys. I had to always trade with my friends. And then it was guys you respect, guys that you, you know, are fans of. This was Didier Drogba, so I was like, oh, I definitely got this. I'm the guy. If there's ever a guy who trades jerseys, I'm the guy.
Not this
London
time.
Woodbury well, comes you know, we'll out get nowhere.
We'll get London Woodbury on the Woodbury. Show.
Are you kidding
to
me?
To get the story. See where he keeps that thing. Oh. Nice, you know, place of honor.
Oh, it hurts. It hurts. Every time I hear it, it just stings.
We could actually turn ETR into a show where people like work out these long-standing beefs. So we got to get London on here.
Yeah,
and,
this
like,
one.
The first... The like secret beef between Charlie and London Woodbury, we could get them to work through it. I think.
Yeah, I mean, and actually,
this.
What you didn't know, Charlie, is I talked to producer Anders, and welcome to the show right now, London Woodbury on the line. London, can you please? No, I'm kidding. We're not doing War of the
London's here because he's ready to milk that jersey for everything he can get out of Charlie.
Yeah, he'll just say, like, "All right, I'll give it to you for $10,000."
Yeah,
that sounds like a good number to me.
That sounds like an absurd number to me.
All right, let's get into the mailbag.
Obviously not
and get out of
big
here.
A Didier Drogba fan. Okay.
401-206-0MLS. Please text us or email us extratime@mlssoccer.com. We will start with this one from the text line. We had this for a while, but we haven't been able to hit it. With Greg Berhalter being hired 6 months to a year too late, do you guys think missing out on more valuable time due to COVID-19 and this pandemic will limit his impact as the U.S. M&T manager in this cycle? It's a bigger question. It's not just Greg Berhalter. It's the whole cycle. It's Canada. It's their attempt to get enough points to get into the hex. It's the Nations League all gone. As you think about international soccer, maybe in particular the U.S. and Canada right now, we'll start with you, Doyle. How do you think this is affecting things? How might it affect things down the line? We don't even know how World Cup qualifying is going to happen at this point.
There are so many variables. I mean, obviously, it's going to affect every coach in the world to one degree or another. And obviously, with national team coaches, they just have less time with their teams. And now that is being taken from them. Add on top of that, that Tyler Adams missed all of last year. Christian Pulisic, Weston McKennie were in and out of the lineups. You know, Josh Sargent is kind of just coming. I don't want to even say coming into his own as a professional player. Like he's having the highs and lows that most young players have. Tim Weah missed most of last year. Like there are still so many moving pieces. It's from my perspective, it's kind of brutal to miss this time for Berhalter and the U.S. national team, especially in considering that like so much of the team is so young. Everybody expected them to make the Olympics. I do think they would have made the Olympics, and then to use that as kind of the ramp to get a lot of the younger guys ready for the national team and ready for World Cup qualifying, which is supposed to begin in September. To have all of that taken away all at once, it's rough. It's very, very rough. And it's going to put a lot of pressure on Berhalter. It's going to put a lot of pressure on these players to come out and execute whatever the system is. I think the good thing that we saw in the last game against Canada and then the game against Costa Rica was that the system's been kind of simplified. And that guys like Sebastian Legette, Jackson Ewell, a few other guys as well. I mean, certainly Aaron Long has been excellent. Guys like that have been able to execute it at the sort of the simplified level. And I think that if you can fill the Tyler Adams and Christian Pulisic of the world in around them, it's like it's going to be, I don't want to say easy, but it's not going to be as complex as what we saw this time last year.
Hopefully this break gives Tyler Adams some time to heal, to get his body right as well. But as Jim Curtin was telling us, you have to calculate rust and all this, not just at the club level, but also at country. So we shall see. A lot to figure out there just as far as scheduling goes. When do you play the games? How do you play the games? I mean, international travel, there's just so many wrinkles in that sense. We'll end it with two emails. This one from Mike, not from Canmore. I don't know what that means, but maybe our Quebecois folks out there know. He says, a few episodes ago, you guys talked about some of your first memories of soccer games, and it led me down this path. He grew up in Montreal when it was a hockey town, aka still is a hockey town. All the sports heroes for kids were Canadiens. Soccer was this game that you'd kind of see the Italian and Portuguese kids in the city playing, but that was really it. And then the World Cup came around and it was on, but it was all about Azzurri, the Italians. This is his game. Before MLS, before the Impact, there was the Manic in NASL from 81 to 83. He says he went with a buddy of his, excuse me, looking back at the stats, he thinks it was the 81 playoff game against the Chicago Sting. Doyle, he wants to know if you remember this era. Gen Xers? No? Okay. He says he doesn't remember anything about the game itself, but the one thing that stays with him is the rush of the emotion of 50,000 plus fans at the Olympic Stadium. And even though he was just 11 years old, he understood on that day, under the rainy summer evening, yes, before Olympic Stadium had a roof, that soccer could make it in Montreal, that the fan base was there if a sustainable league could be developed with other cities. Took a while, but what a joy to see today. The solid MLS fan base is a proper fiery rivalry with TFC and now even the Canadian Premier League. Mike says, thanks to the crew for the Canadian podcast. He's enjoying the Mount Rushmore episodes, Mike. We hope you liked this one with the Impact today. Let us know if you agree or disagree. And we end with David Inskoki, who's a longtime Chicago Fire fan, who did want to make a shout for DeMarcus Beasley, who wasn't really mentioned in Monday's episode, just in passing by Peter Wilt. He says Beasley played longer with the Fire than did Blanco, 4.5 seasons to 2.5, and was, with Landon Donovan, a face of the up-and-coming American soccer program. Seeing him play next to Stoichkov, Novak, and Kubik, all of whom were about twice his age, was awesome. And he also remembers that 2000 season fondly, Beasley and Bocanegra's rookie season. He says he took his girlfriend to a game that summer, warned her before the game that he's a vociferous fan and that it was going to be a deal breaker for the relationship. He understood. He's willing to sacrifice this relationship for soccer and the Fire. He said he'd have no hard feelings. 20 years later, she's Mrs. David Inskoki and has helped raise our sons to be loud and loyal soccer fans. So felt like that was a good way to end it. Thank you, David. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, everybody listening, hanging out with us twice a week.
Real quick, just got to throw in there, belated happy birthday to ETR's own Ricardo Quaresma, Eric Gonzalez, a.k.a. Figo Foods. He's always a legend. He's always there. Happy birthday to the ledge.
Yeah, man. Drink some beers, Eric, in the kitchen. Whip something up. I'm missing your hot sauce. With that, thanks to Jim Curtin. Thank you, Patrice Bernier. Thank you, Charlie, Dave, and Doyle. I'm Andrew. It's Monday. We'll see you Thursday.